Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Laveau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. When one looks back across a chasm of 70 years through a prism of pulp fiction and bad gangster movies, there's a tendency to view the events of 1933 and 1934 as mythic. To the generations of Americans raised since World War II, the identities of criminals such as Charles Pretty Boy Floyd, Babyface Nelson, Ma Barker, John Dillinger, and Clyde Barrow are no more real than are Luke Skywalker or Indiana Jones. After decades spent in the washing machine of popular culture, their stories have been bled of all reality to an extent that few Americans today know who these people actually were, much less that they all rose to national prominence at the same time. So writes our guest this week, Brian Burrow, in the introduction to his new book, Public Enemies, which not only sets the record straight on all of these characters, but also explains how that led to the birth of the FBI. After my conversation with Brian Burrow, Talking History's Fiona Beatty will tell us about a site where you can learn more about the history of the FBI, and Michael Farquhar returns with the third in his 10-part series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. Filmmaker Steven Spielberg, who started a foundation that has collected 52,000 video testimonies of Holocaust survivors and liberators, has announced that he's moving the collection to the University of Southern California in order to fulfill his vision of the archive as a worldwide tool for teaching about injustice and the need for tolerance. Spielberg established the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation in 1994 after he finished filming Schindler's List. Since then, the foundation has collected testimonies from people in 32 languages from 56 countries, including Jews, Roma, homosexuals, and former political prisoners, in a digital archive. When moved to USC, the archive will become part of a new center, the USC Shoah Foundation Institute for Visual History and Education. Spielberg did not attend USC. In fact, he was rejected as a transfer student. But he was later elected to the university's board of trustees, and he told the press that the university's experience with multimedia technologies and its commitment to use that expertise to preserve the archive was an important factor in making the move. In other media news, a film about the Winter Soldier investigation made 34 years ago is finally being released for general public viewing. The documentary, which was circulated on college campuses for decades, has never been accessible to a wider audience until now. The first showing in this release occurred at the Film Society of Lincoln Center in August, but it's now being screened across the nation. Its distributors say the war in Iraq has made the Vietnam-era film as powerful as when it was new. When it was made at a three-day gathering in 1971 of Vietnam veterans telling of the atrocities they had seen and committed, major news organizations sent reporters, but published and broadcast next to nothing of what they filmed, prompting the veterans to organize what would be a pivotal anti-war demonstration in Washington a few months later. When the film was finished, it was shown at various film festivals and in theaters in Europe, but no one would touch it in the United States. When we return, I explore America's greatest crime wave with Brian Burrow. This is Talking History. The early 1930s was a boom time for bank robbers. It was a fabled moment in American history, and criminals like John Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, and the Barker Gang loomed large in the public imagination, more as colorful characters, my guest this week writes, than flesh-and-blood robbers and murderers. He's Brian Burrow, the author of Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave, and the Birth of the FBI, 1933-34, published by Penguin Books. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning.
First question, why was the early 1930s a boom time for bank robbers?
Well, I think the most popular explanation would be just that it was the Depression, and people didn't have a lot of money and were looking for new and sometimes nefarious ways to get it. I argue in the book that I think that's a bit of an oversimplification, that this period in 1933 and 1934 was not the beginning of a crime wave, but it was really the end of a crime wave that began in the mid-20s, when criminals were first given Thompson submachine guns and the V8 engine, which allowed them to outrun and outgun just about every police department out there.
I didn't know that the V8 engine had come in at that point. And this was available to bank robbers, so that made a significant difference in their ability to function?
Well, both the V6 and the V8. You know, at a time where a hometown sheriff might be hand-cranking a Model A, it allowed criminals to get away quickly. And keep in mind, this was before the FBI, so you didn't have multi-jurisdictional justice. I mean, literally, a sheriff couldn't go across his county line, and in most cases, the police weren't going to leave their city.
Why was there greater availability of machine guns, for example?
Thompson submachine gun was introduced in 1919 or 1918, originally being an infantry weapon in World War I. It arrived too late, but the ones who adopted it, by and large, during the 1920s, were gangsters, first in Chicago and then elsewhere.
Okay, and explain a bit more about the limited jurisdiction of the police. What does that mean?
Well, at this time, we have to remember this period in 33 and 34 was the birth of the FBI. There was no national police force before this. All you had were rural sheriffs and urban police departments that were really all too often crippled by nepotism, by corruption, by all sorts of things that hindered their efficiency. And it really wasn't until the passage of the Lindbergh Law, 1932, that gave responsibility for bringing in kidnappers to the FBI that we began to see the beginning of a national police force, and that really blossomed and began to become professional during this period that I write about in 33 and 34 called the War on Crime.
Okay, we're going to come back to the origins of the FBI later, but for now, as I mentioned in the introduction, many of these criminals, when you read about them now, and it was certainly the case back then, their lives read like fables, romantic tales. In many ways, set the record straight. We don't have time to do them all, but let's just take a few and you can talk about them. Let's start with Babyface Nelson.
Tiny guy, about 5'6", raised of Belgian parents in a slum in Chicago, was a real wannabe. Barely a year before he began robbing banks, he was a gangland chauffeur out in Reno, Nevada, till he ran into a member of the Barker Gang who let him know how great it was robbing banks in the Midwest, and he came back and started doing it in 33 and 34, eventually partnered with John Dillinger. And Nelson is remembered as almost a caricature of the wild-eyed machine gunner, a young fella, and keep in mind he died when he was only 26, who literally would turn around and fire bullets all over a small town and laugh during a bank robbery.
I want to save John Dillinger because there's a connection there that we'll pick up on later. But you mentioned the Barkers. Tell us a little bit more about them.
Barker Gang is probably the least known of the six criminal elements that I'm writing about here. And what you may remember them for, the character of Ma Barker, played by Shelley Winters in a otherwise forgettable 1969 movie by Roger Corman. I suppose the most interesting thing that I had to offer about the Barker Gang is just the idea that the FBI, which ultimately killed Ma Barker and one of her sons, Fred Barker, in early 1935, enshrined her as kind of a criminal mastermind of this gang, this 60-something-year-old grandmother. And I argue, based on the lack of evidence found in FBI files, that she not only wasn't a criminal mastermind, she wasn't a criminal. She never planned a bank robbery. She never robbed a bank. All she did was kind of live off the ill-gotten gains of her sons, who were bank robbers. But the problem became that the FBI killed her accidentally when they killed her son. And I think Hoover, rather than wait for the question, why did you kill Grandma, decided to enshrine Grandma as a criminal mastermind.
Great story. Okay. Machine Gun Kelly.
Machine Gun Kelly was probably the worst, the least effective of the major Depression area of criminals. From Memphis, ultimately captured in Memphis, spent a good time of his early career in Kansas City as a grocery clerk and then as a bootlegger. Really, Kelly was a bank robber pretty bad bank robber who worked all across the country in 31 and 32, got so nervous before bank jobs that he tended to vomit. Ultimately got tired of bank robberies. You know, he was tired of getting shot at, so he tried his hand at kidnapping. He kidnapped the wealthiest oil man in Oklahoma, a fellow named Charles Urschel, in the summer of 33. Actually, the ransom was passed here in Kansas City, and ultimately the FBI got on his trail. It was the FBI's second major kidnapping case, and Kelly was the first of the major Depression-era criminals that the FBI was actually able to capture.
You mentioned how film can make some of these criminals famous. We certainly had a great film, a better film than the one you mentioned earlier, on Bonnie and Clyde. So tell us a little bit about them.
Well, Bonnie and Clyde have probably been the subject of the most revisionism of any of the criminals that I wrote about. You're right, the 1967 film was an amazing film. Unfortunately, it's a film. If it was nonfiction, they'd call it a documentary. Clyde Barrow was a spree killer, a serial killer, who killed about 12, 13 innocent men. And Bonnie Parker was a deluded 21-year-old who basically was bored, having been abandoned by her husband, and went out with Clyde because she wanted some excitement. They had almost no redeeming characteristics. They were even ineffective as bank robbers. At a time where the Barkers could bring in $200,000 with a single kidnapping, Clyde Barrow's biggest bank robbery was about $3,500, we believe. And in fact, he robbed far more grocery stores and drug stores than he ever did banks. The only reason that they lasted as long as they did, that they managed to stay alive, was that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI believed them too insignificant to go after. And they left the matter to local lawmen in Texas, who ultimately found them and gunned them down in rural Louisiana in early 34.
Pretty Boy Floyd?
Well, he's your local hero or your local anti-hero here in Kansas City, depending on your feeling. Pretty Boy Floyd is wholly a creature of eastern Oklahoma in the Depression. When they wanted a big night in a town or to find a bootlegger, often they would come into Kansas City. It was their nearest really urban center. Floyd, I find a less than sympathetic character because he was just a whiner, Brian. He was very much early on into the culture of victimization. When he disappeared following the Kansas City massacre in the summer of 1933, reporters were always interviewing his family down in Oklahoma, and all they did was whine about how the police had pestered poor Pretty Boy Floyd into becoming a bank robber and that he really had no choice. And, of course, that's not true. Ultimately, he was gunned down and found in eastern Ohio, of all places, in fall of 34.
Let me turn the question around a bit. Did any of these characters that really became fables during their own time and after, when you got done researching them, did any of them strike you as perhaps meriting that kind of coverage? Were there any that had any kind of romantic twist to them at all, or were they just straight-out criminals and got what they deserved?
In terms of romance, Bonnie and Clyde were the only ones that literally had romance. In the larger connotation of the word, John Dillinger was the only one who was a real romantic figure. Dillinger is the only one of these major criminals that you can almost see as a human being. You can understand why he did what he did, and that because he went out of his way not to harm people, he just wanted the money, as he said time and time again. He ultimately did kill one detective and apologized and felt awful for it the rest of his life. Dillinger was the one that you could identify with, that you could connect with.
Okay, and I left Dillinger out. I'll bring him up now because you make a point that it was really Dillinger and the pursuit of Dillinger that leads to the rise of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. So make those connections for us.
Well, the Dillinger case was and is probably the most important case in FBI history. Even as the FBI was kind of blundering around trying to find the Barkers and Pretty Boy Floyd and some of these others that we've mentioned, John Dillinger became, in a very short time, the most celebrated bank robber in the Midwest. He was paroled from penitentiary in Indiana in May 1933, having spent 9 years for the drunken mugging of a local grocer in his hometown outside of Indianapolis. Basically, what he did was he went and robbed banks to raise enough money to break all his buddies out of prison, which in September 33, about 4 months later, he actually did. And they formed a gang that went out and began robbing banks in the Chicago area, Wisconsin, Indianapolis. Anyway, long story short, they were apprehended in Arizona. Dillinger ultimately escaped from jail in an infamous incident in which he used a wooden gun to round up a bunch of local guards and deputies, and that's when the FBI got on his trail. He ultimately teamed up with Babyface Nelson, and over a 4 or 5 month period really became just about the only news in the country as the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover tried to bring him in, and ultimately did.
What did that lead to for the FBI once they brought him in? Did this elevate their status nationally? Did it change their position legally?
It was really the first time that most of America had even heard of the FBI. Before this period, this 22-month period that we're talking about, the FBI could not arrest people. They couldn't carry guns. Their jurisdiction was limited to really insignificant federal crimes, things like crimes on Indian reservations, crimes at sea, crimes in Alaska. It was only really when they were given responsibility for bringing in kidnappers and then interstate fugitives that the FBI rose to kind of national prominence. Bonnie and Clyde were killed in, I believe it was May 34, then Dillinger in July, Floyd in October, Nelson in November, the Barkers the following January, almost all except Bonnie and Clyde by the FBI. By the end of that period, the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover had become national heroes and become kind of the centralized national police force that we know them as today.
If you had to put a date on it, what year, and then when did they actually become known as the FBI?
Good point. At this point, when all this happened, they were actually only the BI, the Bureau of Investigation. The name was changed officially the following spring in 1935.
Okay. You also mentioned, and you've made reference a couple times now to being in Kansas City, so tell us a little bit about the Kansas City Massacre that also is very important here.
To Kansasians of a certain age, I don't need to say a word, but I'm always amazed that people of younger generations, I'm 43, younger than me, may never have heard of the Kansas City Massacre, but it was the triggering event for all the events that we're talking about. It occurred in the middle of June 1933 when a group of FBI men had captured an otherwise insignificant bank robber named Frank Nash and brought him up to Kansas City on the way to returning him to Leavenworth, where he had escaped several years earlier. While they were in the parking lot at Union Station here in Kansas City, they were ambushed by a number of unknown assassins. Five men were killed, including an FBI man and two local Kansas City policemen. And it was the assassination of the FBI man in particular that propelled J. Edgar Hoover to declare war kind of on kidnappers and bank robbers in the Midwest. And it was within a month they're confronting the likes of the Barkers and Machine Gun Kelly and everything. So it was the events that began here in Kansas City that started this whole war on crime period and that really led to the creation of the modern FBI.
Okay, and you mentioned that the crime wave that we're talking about, this is really the end of the crime wave, that it began in the 20s and wound down in the early 30s. So once this was done, how did the FBI go forward from that point to continue its prominence to the place that it held by today, certainly?
You're right. This kind of period of 22 months was the crucible, the birth of the FBI. And, you know, the FBI really did an amazing job of stamping out kidnapping for that period of time in the mid-30s, and to a large extent, bank robbery. After this period, the FBI, by the late 30s, began to chase communists. During the World War II, it was Nazi spies, but for many, many years, the FBI retained its national significance by being not only experts on crime, but particularly experts on ferreting out communism in the country, often to the detriment of going after perhaps criminals like the Italian Mafia that others thought they should have gone after.
You mentioned at least two major kidnappings. Was there a wave of major kidnappings in this time period, or is it just a coincidence? You mentioned Lindbergh, for example.
Lindbergh was the kind of the trigger event of that, and that suddenly led to a rash of copycat kidnappings throughout the Midwest. The first in Denver, then in Oklahoma City, two big ones by the Barkers in St. Paul, all of well-known millionaires. And basically what had happened is, you recall that about half the nation's banks had been closed during 1932 and 1933, and those that remained got tired of being robbed, and they began to arm their guards. And a lot of the criminal gangs that we're discussing, like the Barkers, felt that kidnapping was a less dangerous way of bringing in big money, that they were tired of going after banks and getting shot at.
How did you come on this topic? It's a fascinating one. It seems an obvious one, but there must be most of the writers I interview have a reason. They stumble on it for some unknown.
Well, my connection to the material was my grandfather, who was a deputy sheriff in Northwest Arkansas in the early 30s. And every time there was a Bonnie and Clyde bank robbery anywhere in the region, the local Barney Fives would be put out on the city limits to make sure they didn't come into town. And thankfully, he never saw them, found them, or was forced to shoot at them. Then one night in the late 90s, I was watching one of these A&E biographies late at night on Ma Barker. And I found myself wondering, well, when was Ma Barker vis-a-vis Bonnie and Clyde? Well, long story short, after about 2 hours on the internet, I found that all six of these criminal elements were at large at the very same time. And, of course, my reaction was, boy, I bet that's a great book. I got to go get that book. And I found that there was no such book. There were books on the individual outlaws, but no one had put it together as a single story, with the unifying element being the FBI. And no one had really pointed out that this was when the FBI became the FBI.
Yeah, well, it's a great book and it's a great read. What are you working on now?
Looks like I'm originally from Texas, and I'm going to tackle the world of Texas oil, the rise and fall of the great Texas oil families during the middle part of the 20th century.
Great. When can we expect that?
In several years.
Several years. Okay, very good. Well, we'll have you back in several years then. Well, great. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Brian Burrow, the author of Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933 to 1934, published by Penguin Books. This is Talking History.
L'histoire de Jesse James. Comment il vécu? Comment il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Eh bien, écoutez l'histoire de Bonnie and Clyde. Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle. Son prénom c'est Bunny. À eux deux ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom
Bunny Parker
et Clyde Barrow.
Bunny and Clyde. Bunny and Clyde.
As a follow-up to my conversation with Brian Burrow on the creation of the FBI, Fiona Beatty is here to tell you where you can learn more about that organization and its history.
The FBI Museum in Washington, D.C. has been closed since 9/11, but thanks to the digitization of thousands of documents, cyber visitors have much to learn from the website. Click on History under Learn About Us and become immersed. For an overview, there's a detailed account of the history of the FBI from its origins in 1908 through the present, arranged in chronological order under categories such as Lawless Years, 1921 to 1933, the New Deal, 1933 to late 30s, and Change of Mandate in 2001. Included in this overview are photographs and biographies of directors past and present and links to famous cases, such as the Rosenbergs and John Dillinger, complete with a photograph of him smirking in twisted fashion. The electronic reading room provides downloadable documents arranged alphabetically and by categories like espionage, famous persons, gangster era, historical interest, unusual phenomena, and violent crime. Among the famous persons you might be surprised to find on file are Jackie Kennedy, the Beatles, Gracie Allen, Thurgood Marshall, and Walter Winchell, all for, quote, a variety of different reasons. To find out more, go to www.fbi.gov.
Finally, in another of our special series we air from time to time on Talking History, Michael Farquhar returns for the third of his readings from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week, Farquhar, a writer and editor for The Washington Post, has selected a tale told in part three of his book, The Wars of the Ruses, on the hoodwinking of Adolf Hitler.
The hoodwinking of Hitler during the Allied invasion of France in 1944 was one of the most elaborate deceptions in history. It also may very well have saved civilization. Never in the history of warfare had there been such a staggering challenge, to smash through the Nazi fortress of Europe from the sea, and never had secrecy and surprise been more imperative. If Hitler learned that the Allied assault was to be centered at Normandy, he would mass his forces there and shred the invaders as they landed. The expedition would be doomed. Hundreds of thousands of lives would be lost, and the war effort gravely compromised. It was critical, therefore, that Allied intentions be carefully hidden. Churchill once remarked that in warfare, truth is so precious that she must be attended by a bodyguard of lies. From this comment emerged the code name for all the cover and deception operations surrounding the invasion of Europe, Plan Bodyguard. One of the most ambitious in the Allied bodyguard of lies was the 1st United States Army Group, an almost entirely fictitious fighting force. What appeared to be a massive buildup of 50 divisions and a million men in southeastern England was in reality a masterful illusion. The object was to make Hitler think the Allies intended to invade at Calais and that Normandy was only a diversion to draw German forces away from the prime landing spot. The creation of the imaginary army group turned a swath of southeastern England into something like a giant film set, dwarfing any spectacle Cecil B. DeMille ever produced. From the air it was to appear that a mighty force was gathering. Rivers around the region were filled with fake landing ships made of tubular scaffolding and canvas. Other elements of the army group were fabricated as well, including ammunition dumps, field kitchens, hospitals, troop encampments, and fuel lines. There were inflatable tanks and even a huge fake oil dock from which a pipeline under the English Channel would supposedly supply the invasion force at Calais. Sporadic radio noises meant to simulate a large army group were periodically sent out, while planted newspaper stories described life around the ever-expanding military base. To give the ruse even more credibility, General George Patton was sent to Britain to head the Phantom Force. At the same time, German agents under Allied control fed the Nazis false information about the massive buildup. On D-Day, the largest invasion force ever assembled stormed Normandy and gave the Allies a foothold on the continent. To maintain it, though, Hitler had to remain convinced that an even larger force was poised to strike Calais. Otherwise, he would send his strongest armies to Normandy, with devastating consequences. All the activity that preceded the Normandy invasion was mimicked at Calais. Hitler was thoroughly fooled, and despite pleas from his generals at Normandy to send reinforcements, he insisted that his strongest forces remain at Calais to defend it from the onslaught that never came.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.